There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. But how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? How do we talk with other people and speak the truth in love? How do we communicate the gospel in the midst of a culture of confusion in a way that honors Jesus? I mean, let's face it, people don't need another piece of our mind, but they very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So how can we give that to them? Well, I invite you to connect with us online. We have resources posted for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, folks, lots of news this week, and I want to actually reach back to Time Magazine's cover story from last week and then talk about Time Magazine's cover story for this week and tell you why I think they have missed their own responsibility in the midst of the question that they're trying to ask on this week's cover. So I got to reach back to last week. Time's cover story was Beyond He or She. It was about how, in their view, a new generation is redefining the meaning of gender. So beyond he and she. And there was a person featured on the cover who was intentionally supposed to be distinctly neither male nor female, he nor she. And to get to the question that Time Magazine is asking this week on its cover, which is truth dead? I think you have to pass through the postmodern assertion from last week's cover that there's no longer an understanding of gender as binary, he or she. Self-described gender fluidity along a spectrum is now, Time Magazine tells us, the new normal. Well, that is actually such a delusional departure from the observable truth, the basic truth of reality, that this week's cover article asking if truth is dead, in my view, naturally follows. So, quickly from last week, beyond the Time cover story, beyond he and she, Katie Steinmetz actually posts this about Time Magazine's cover story, and she's reporting here for Time. It's essentially about the fact that according to this new research, which, by the way, is done by a pro-LGBTQ organization called GLAAD, teenagers and 20-somethings reject notions of what society has told them about who they are supposed to be. Well, there's nothing revolutionary about that. Teenagers are always exploring and rejecting what society has said and seeking what is going to be culturally normative for the next generation. However, in this particular conversation, what they mean by that is that this next generation of young people is, quote, redefining everything. Now, if we're going to redefine everything, then we have arrived at the state of Babel, where literally no one understands anything about anyone else. It's literally just nonsense spoken in the culture, because even words don't have meaning if we're redefining everything. So clearly they're not redefining everything. So what's the scope of the redefinition that's in view here by Time Magazine article last week, Beyond He and She? Well, here is the sentence in the middle of the article by Katie Steinmetz that you would want to take hold of in your mind. They believe that both sexuality and gender are less like a toggle between this or that, and more like a spectrum that allows for many, even endless, permutations of identity. Just think about that for a moment. An endless number, an endless variety, an endless spectrum of permutations of identity. And then here is the walk-off, which leads us into the conversation about Time Magazine's cover article this week. Here's the walk-off paragraph. Young people are not saying, which I won't say here in the article what it says, but what they are saying is, your terms, what you're trying to do, does not reflect my reality or the reality of my friends. My reality, the reality of my friends, suggests a concept of my truth, the truth of my friends, because truth is actually that which accords with reality. And so we're not talking about the redefinition of everything, as the article suggests. We are, however, talking about the redefinition or the attempt to redefine reality. And in so doing, to redefine truth, because truth is that which accords with reality, leading us straight in to the Time Magazine cover article this week, which for those of you who have been around any length of time, you're going to take a second look at and say, hey, I think I have seen that exact same cover before. And it's very close to a cover that you've seen before, but not quite. The April 8th, 1966 cover of Time Magazine was black with red lettering and asked the question, is God dead? This time around, the cover looks exactly the same, but the one word has changed, and the question is this, is truth dead? And the question that they're really trying to plumb is about President Donald Trump in an interview about truth and falsehood. And what they're trying to do is plumb the depths of what truth means and whether or not our president has any particular relationship to it. So here's what I would like to say in terms of commentary on these two Time Magazine cover pictures, cover stories. If you have to ask either question, is God dead or is truth dead? Then you have to pause and recognize that what you are talking about, if it's dead, it had to have died, and therefore it had to have at one point in time lived. Well, if there's a question that God may be dead, then there's also the reality that at one point God was alive. Same with the truth. But a living God who is really God cannot die. And the second question, is truth dead, is actually synonymous with the first. Why is that? Because God is truth. So if 51 years ago, Americans were wondering if God were dead, it's no great surprise, or it should be no great surprise, that Americans today might be wondering if truth is dead as well. The surprise might be that it took us 5 decades to ask the second question. Truth has consequences, and the denial of truth has consequences as well. If there are lies, and it seems to me that there's no shortage of people throwing that term around, suggesting that there are lies and that there are liars. Well, it seems to me that if there are lies, the existence of lies implies the existence of truth. But what truth? Whose truth? Remember, we have this self-described post-truth culture. And in this self-described post-truth culture, the question of whether or not God and therefore truth is a living reality, something substantive, is a real question. Now, for those of us who know God to be real, for those of us who are actively walking step by step with the Spirit of the living God every day, for those of us who are even in this very moment seeking to have, by the power of the Holy Spirit at work within us, allowing every thought to be taken captive, that we might have the very mind of Christ on the matters of the day, for us, God's not only alive, God is active and present and functioning as the operating system of our lives. He's more real to us than the people in the room with us or in the car next to us. So front and center in this conversation in Time Magazine is the question of a person's relationship with the truth. And the person in view here is the president. But I have to ask, why is anyone surprised that our president is defining his own truth? He has grown up in a culture that has said truth is self-defined. Identity is self-defined. Reality is self-defined. Why is anyone surprised that he is now defining his own truth, identifying his own facts, advocating for his own reality? Our systems of higher education, the entire culture of Hollywood, and indeed the mainline church, all of these institutions have been telling Donald Trump for more than 50 years that truth is relative, truth is personal, truth is subjective. We can find or follow our own truth. I just think that's what the president's just naturally doing. Now, I don't think it's right, but I don't think it should surprise us. Truth has not been seen in our culture as objective since the mid-1960s. even when facts are presented to the contrary. That doesn't seem to matter. If you feel a certain way about something, then that is your truth. That's what our culture says. Even something as scientifically verifiable and physically obvious as your gender. That's right. That's where last week's cover story and this week's cover story run together on the presses. Now, here's the good news. The fact that people are bothered by Trump's sort of own truth indicates that there's still some residue of understanding in our culture that truth is actually something real, something substantive, something objective. Truth is that which accords with reality, factual, observable, objective reality. And this is where the challenge is going to be posed to those who advocate on the side of identity politics. Because in Donald Trump, identity politics just has one new character. The discord between what is declared to be personally true, no matter the facts, and what can be easily observed and verified, only seems to bother people when that truth is Trumpian. It doesn't seem to bother people when that truth comes with a letter LGBTQ or one of the other 60 options on Facebook. Those are self-defined truths as well, and they're just as false as Trump's truths. Those asking the question of whether or not President Trump can handle the truth need to look at how the truth has been handled by those who made Trump who he is. The academy which trained him, the church which raised him, the reality TV Hollywood set who made him a celebrity. If truth is dead, you are the ones who killed it. It's simply blind for Time magazine to feign alarm this week at the post-truth president, when just last week they contributed to the post-truth culture in their own cover article. And looking back to the cover from April the 8th, 1966, you can see that at least Time magazine has been in the truth destruction business in our culture for a very long time. Handling in the truth are called to do. The question of whether or not the president can handle the truth is a question that each and every one of us should ask. How am I handling the truth? As Christians, we know the truth. The truth has set us free. The truth is what we hold in our hands when we read the Bible. We need to start taking the question of handling the truth with great seriousness and much greater care. For indeed, we are living in a nation that loves its lies and has become a bunch of liars. Transitioning to the other big story, or another big story from this week, is the ongoing challenge of the passage of healthcare reform. I know this is a conversation we've been having for a while. This is a conversation that is not over yet. The House is supposed to be voting soon on the question of the plan as it stands now, as it was amended overnight. Here's what I want to be sure that you're aware of. So the president basically issued an ultimatum to lawmakers. The president wants to know who's standing with him. His ultimatum is basically, look, get it done now, or I'm moving on. The president delivered the ultimatum to House Republicans on Thursday night. Vote to approve the measure to overhaul the nation's healthcare system on the House floor on Friday, or reject it, and the president is going to move on with other legislative priorities. But what the president is really looking for, and is looking for in other ways than just the vote on this, he's asking the question of who is standing with him. Now, who is standing with me is not a question of policy or legislation. Who is standing with me is a question of loyalty. It's personal. Are you with me? Or are you against me? Now, I think that with that kind of question before us, as Christians, we need to be praying for the president. I'm praying that he comes to know that living a life for the applause of men is futile. A life of freedom and meaning is ultimately lived only before an audience of one. And that one is not anybody walking around today. John chapter 12 reminds us that in Jesus' day, many of the leaders believed in him, But they were afraid of those who were in power. It actually says they were afraid of the Pharisees. And for fear of the Pharisees, for fear of those in leadership, for fear of being put out of the place of importance, because they loved the praise of men more than they loved the praise of God. Galatians 1, chapter 10 says this about the Apostle Paul. It's actually the Apostle Paul speaking here. He says, look, am I seeking the approval of men, or am I seeking the approval of God? Am I trying to please God or men? If I'm still trying to please God, I cannot be a servant of Christ. So on this question of who's standing with me, I think that for me, the question is, with whom am I standing? I want to be standing with Jesus. Wherever he's standing, whatever he's doing, whatever he's got going on, that's the guy I want to be with. Because that's the applause that I'm looking for. I'm looking to satisfy the heart's desire of God, to do the will of the Father. So ask yourself, am I seeking the applause of the world, or am I seeking the applause of the one who is in heaven? This is about our mindset. This is about what our mind is set on. This is about what our heart is set on. This is about how we live our day. It's also how we feel about ourselves when we put our head on our pillow at night. Did I live today as unto the Lord? All right, we've got also ongoing the Senate hearing, confirmation hearings related to Judge Neil Gorsuch. You are well aware that for 3 days this week, the Senate Judiciary Committee has been literally grilling Judge Neil Gorsuch. And now pretty much those questions, all of the questions that they could think to ask have been asked. Those hearings are over. And now we move into this process of actually, what does it look like to take a vote to confirm this guy? Well, the confirmation hearings may be over, but the political fireworks, it does not look like they have come to an end. The Democrats are saying that they intend to filibuster the vote. Now, basically, that means they're going to keep talking so long that it makes it impossible to get on with the business of actually taking a vote. So, excuse me, the editorial board of the Washington Post has this to say to Democrats. Democrats, you should make a deal on Gorsuch. And I think that I would agree with that. I don't expect the Democrats to just back down. I don't expect them to give in. I also do not think it is a great idea for Republican-led House to simply eliminate the filibuster on Supreme Court nominees by satisfying themselves with a simple majority vote. I think that would be an unwise thing to do in terms of the future. I think that is potentially injurious to both parties in the future. So is there a third option? Well, the guys at the guys, I don't really know that they're guys. The editorial board at the Washington Post says there's a third option. The parties could strike a deal that would preserve the filibuster for the minority party in the case of future nominees while providing for an up or down vote on this particular confirmation. So they say that would not deepen the polarization and would provide a path forward. So there you go. We'll see what happens with that in the coming weeks. I don't expect that to take place here in the next couple of days, but at least there are some options available. All right, friends, there is this ongoing issue related to Tim Keller and the Presbyterians. And if you had the ability to like draw yourself out a chart of the complex nature of relationships among Presbyterians, then I'd be able to tell you that the Princeton Presbyterians, who don't like the kind of Presbyterian that Tim Keller is, the Princeton Presbyterians are very pro-LGBTQ advocacy. And the kind of Presbyterian that Tim Keller is happens to be Presbyterian Church in America. And they don't. They don't recognize any special rights or special liberties or special status for people who self-identify in these ways. And so Princeton Seminary is where this story takes place. And only because it has now risen to the level of national conversation And because it's the seminary that happens to be my alma mater, do I keep bringing this up? So thank you for the moment of personal privilege to continue to share this with you. Case Thorpe has an editorial posted on the Wall Street Journal website, and it was actually in the print edition of the Wall Street Journal on Friday, March the 24th, entitled "A Seminary Snubs a Presbyterian Pastor." And he talks in here about the way the seminary has rescinded the invitation. Well, actually, they didn't rescind the invitation for Tim Keller to speak, but they rescinded the prize for which he was coming to give the speech. So there you go. Here's what I want to say about the whole thing. We've really arrived at a place where if you do not bow the knee to the agenda of the LGBTQ plus advocates, then you have failed to uphold what is now viewed as the one essential tenet of the Reformed faith among this particular version, this particular variety of Presbyterianism. And that is the PCUSA, Presbyterian Church, United States of America. And you say to yourself, well, isn't that really the Presbyterian Church? And no, it's not. There are actually more than a dozen Presbyterian denominations in the United States of America. And the one that is shrinking precipitously, that is on a downhill membership and congregational decline, is this mainline liberal variety known as the Presbyterian Church USA. The Presbyterians of whom Tim Keller is a part, the Presbyterian Church in America, is actually actively planting churches across the United States, and Tim Keller is a part of that church planting movement. So there's this new fundamentalism afoot, and the new fundamentalism is basically saying you must absolutely bend the knee to the agenda of the LGBTQ people, and that is really ultimately what this is about. Anybody who says this is about women's ordination is not paying attention. You're having a debate of a time now long gone. All right, friends. Let's bring today's conversation related to the events of the week to a conclusion here before the break. There's a couple of really important things that happened this week that I don't want to lose track of. And we certainly want to continue to be praying for those affected by the terrorist attack in London this week. We also want to be praying for people in the Jewish community. In addition to the person who perpetrated the terrorist attack in London being a person who is British, the folks in America who have been dealing with, since the first of the year, hundreds of bomb threats at Jewish community centers across the United States, they have now found out that the person who was making those bomb threats is Jewish. The reaction is heartbreak, dismay, confusion. This is, for those of us who are Christians, and we recognize the power of the betrayal of a friend, that's the depth of angst that's caused when someone who's on the inside of the community, you know, a member of the community in London perpetrating this attack against his own city, a member of the Jewish community, an Israeli who is also an American citizen, perpetrating this against his, in a sense, his own people. Now, both are threats that came from the inside. And I think that as we approach Holy Week, and we all recognize who Judas is, and we all recognize what Judas does in the Garden of Gethsemane, and we all recognize that hurts worse than anybody else doing something bad to you. When it's somebody in your own family, when it's somebody in your own close-knit circle of friends, when it's a close colleague at work, when it's another member of the church, nothing hurts worse than a betrayal that's close by. Why is that? Well, because it's really hard for other people to betray us. In order to betray someone, there has to be a relationship, and there has to be a sense of mutual trust. So I want us to be praying, again, for the folks in London and the families affected, and the Jewish Community Center and the folks in Israel related to this internal threat. Hey folks, when we come back, we're going to be talking with Luther Whitlock about what's happening ecumenically among evangelicals. Visit us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Stay with us through the break. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. Indeed, I've been undone by the grace of the Lord. I hope you have too. Here on The Reconnect, we are seeking to put God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about, and we're talking with the people who are helping us talk about the things we ought to be talking about. And so today I have with us Luter Whitlock. Luter is, for 23 years, he served as the president of Reformed Theological Seminary. He currently serves as the president and executive director of the CNL Charitable Foundation and the Cinna Family Foundation in Orlando. You probably recognize his name from lots of environments and places across evangelical Christianity, particularly in the Reformed tradition. He's the author of Spiritual Quest. He is the husband of Mary Lou, who is probably the most delightful person I've ever met, and I am thrilled to be speaking with him today. It's his first time to be on The Reconnect, so let's welcome him. Luter, welcome to The Reconnect.
Well, thanks, Carmen, and I like my wife, too.
I know. She's just precious. She's just, we are not going to talk about her today, necessarily, unless you just want to. I thought what we would jump into, because you have a more expansive viewpoint of evangelicalism, of the Reformed tradition, probably more expansive than anybody else I know. So what I would love for you to do is give us some historical perspective on what we think we're seeing today in terms of the difficulty people are having defining evangelicals and evangelicalism across the culture.
Oh, sure. Happy to do that. Well, first of all, historically, most people would have said someone who believes in the authority of the Bible and that you are saved by faith alone through God's grace alone and not by your works, that would have made you an evangelical. The authority of the Bible, faith in Christ, all of God's grace and not of works, those things would have delineated any evangelical. Now, there could have been things that would have been distinctive and made you a Methodist or Presbyterian or a Baptist, but all of us would have been evangelicals. And going far back in the history of the country, we would have all said, you know, we're all believers, we're all in it together, we may be in different congregations or denominations, but we're all in Christ.
So, Luter, I think that there's a lot of people listening right now who are thinking to themselves, that's just what a Christian is. What you've defined is sort of the basic definition of a self-described Christian. However, we then find ourselves beginning to slice the theological pie, or at least the denominational pie, from that point forward, and we end up in a much more divided reality than the very unified reality that you just described. If everybody who is a Christian would simply describe themselves in the way that you just did, I think that we'd have a much more unified understanding of ourselves and our witness. So can you speak to the unity question of Christianity in America?
Yeah, I'll say a couple things, Carmen. One is that not everybody in a Christian denomination or congregation would agree with what I said. And part of the problem started back in the 19th century with the increased influence of what we would call the natural and the social sciences. And so some people became nervous as science became more prominent and influential. There were a lot of people who were leading pastors or educators, and they said, wow, if we don't conform to this, then we're going to lose credibility. And so at that point, they rejected the authority of the scriptures in favor of the authority of science. And that led to all kinds of changes in terms of theological positions and the like. Eventually, it led to what was called the fundamentalist modernist controversy in the early 20th century and to divisions across all denominations. It just left a landscape of broken churches and people. And we've been recovering from that ever since.
Well, you say we're recovering from it. I actually think we're like in a new phase of it. I feel like there's actually a new fundamentalism that's on the rise, and it's the It's the exact opposite of the kind of fundamentalism that fundamentalists were accused of in the fundamentalist modernist controversy to which you're referring. It feels like the new fundamental, the thing that you have to bow down to in certain segments of particularly mainline Christianity today is a sexual revolution, is a completely different way of understanding identity than that which is described in the Bible. And so I feel like there's a whole new wave upon us in terms of those conversations where it almost goes beyond the ability to have a cogent conversation because there's like no shared basis in the truth anymore. So from your perspective, tell me what you see in the landscape today in terms of what is the word Christian and the word church gets used in our culture by such a wide variety of organizations and institutions and people. So can you just speak to that?
Yeah, you're right. And I think I would build on my prior statement by saying there are lots of people associated with Christianity who don't really accept the authority of the Bible and therefore its teachings or the preeminence of Christ and the like. You say, well, then what is it, and why do we see all these strange things in terms of emphasis on certain sexual matters and the like? And the way I would explain it is a lot of it is part of what we see in terms of a kind of progressive agenda. And that progressive agenda, some have referred to as postmodernism, or with other terms, but essentially, it becomes a way of rejecting the forms of authority we have historically accepted, like natural revelation and natural theology and natural law, or the Bible. And in place of that, you have a social construct that becomes determinative. And part of the agenda behind some of this is actually Marxist. And so what you see is we live with people who are oppressors. There are those who have oppressed women. There are those who have oppressed gays and others. And therefore, we need to be militant enough to deal with these people, put them in their place, and right the wrongs that have occurred. And that's the kind of agenda that's in play.
Well, I know that your heart is for a visible unity in terms of the witness of the Christian church in the world today. And I look forward to talking with you. I know you are working on the publication of a book, and so I certainly hope that when it comes out, you can come back on and talk about that, because I know that the church and the unity of the witness of Christ in the world is, I know that's where your heart beats. So I want to spend the rest of the time that we have talking about that concept. Obviously, we all know from John chapter 17 that, the heart of it is that we would have this unified witness in order that the world would know Jesus. Like, that's the point. So cast your vision of a new ecumenism or a restored unified witness of the church world today.
Well, there are two kinds of people. There are those who truly believe in Christ and those who don't. And it seems to me those of us who genuinely believe in Christ and accept the message of the Scriptures, we are one. We're one family in the Lord, and we need to find appropriate ways to express that. As you know, members of the family don't always agree, and sometimes there's more than a little friction, but they're members of a family, and they acknowledge that and work through all the differences. And we're in a place where those of us who really trust in the Lord have got to learn to work constructively with each other. We need to love each other as members of a family. We need to learn to appreciate differences and realize that diversity can sometimes enrich and make our lives better and more wonderful. We need to work through the differences and know that even that process can strengthen us. But finding that unity will present a testimony of strength to an unbelieving world. And frankly, the way our world is becoming so partisan and fragmented, people are going to have to learn to work together. And I was part of a research group about a year ago in which we discovered that 80% of the American population is looking for a way to have more constructive conversations. They want to find a way to bring people together. It seems to me Christians should be the ones leading the charge on this.
Well, I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, you know, that's my heart. I mean, like, I want to help people be able to talk with one another, and certainly want Christians to be equipped in those conversations to not just speak for themselves, but to speak the mind of Christ in a way that honors Him. And so do you have, you know, you got one practical idea for listeners out there how they can begin doing that either in the context of their own church or in their own small group or in their community?
I'd say the first thing, Carmen, is you've just got to love other people. If you love other people, you're going to try to treat them right and do by them. And a second thing that works with that is look to build trust. If you have love and trust, you can have strong relationships and enable you to conquer all kinds of problems. That's true of a marriage. And it's true of other parts of life, too. So I think that'd be a good place to start.
So we're talking with Luther Whitlock. He has such a resume that just goes on and on. So I'm just going to tell people that you're the 23 years past president of Reformed Theological Seminary and right now seeking to bless evangelical Christians in the culture by casting a vision for a new ecumenism, a new way of demonstrating to the world the unity of Christ, even amidst a people who have lots of personal differences. Luther, before I let you go, you know, I mean, I know that you're paying attention to cultural things as much as I am, and our Southern Baptist friends have maybe not been publicly demonstrating all of the unity of the Spirit that they might have been. Presbyterians right now with the Tim Keller kerfluffle with Princeton may not be publicly bearing witness to this unified understanding of the body. Can you just, for folks who see what happens in the church and say to themselves, if that's Christianity, I don't want any part of it, I want you to invite them into the relationship with the guy who you know is really the one they need to be with?
Well, of course, the one they need to be connected to is our Savior, Lord Jesus Christ. He'll make all the difference in the world. Carmen, as I look at these other situations, it seems to me there are a couple things that can be said. One is that when there are differences, it's always better to try to resolve those privately in appropriately respectful and kind manner. If we're willing to do that, we can overcome a lot of these difficulties. When we go public and excoriate people or treat them badly or perhaps even say things that aren't true, we simply add to the estrangement. And I think both of the things you mentioned are typical of that. I know both of the leaders who are involved. And I just regret these things occurring. If I were talking to an individual, let's say a pastor, what I'd say to him is, look, if you've got a problem, bend over backwards to understand the other person and try to build a relationship in which you can really talk about the differences. You've got your disagreements. And if you find a way to do that, you may find life can become very different. In the book that's coming out, I give a number of examples of people where there were significant differences, but kindness and patience and honesty and accuracy enable them to get over those differences and actually build good relationships.
So, Luter, the copy of the book that I'm holding in my hand today is still the April 2016 working draft, not for distribution, working title, The Church, Unity and Community. Is that still the title we're going to be looking for here in a month or so?
Actually, it's like every title, it gets changed. This one is now Divided We Fall, Overcoming a History of Christian Disunity, and it'll be due out May 31st.
Oh, fantastic. All right, we're going to be looking for it. Divided We Fall by Luter Whitlock. We'll be looking for that at the end of May, and we look forward to having a conversation with you about it once it's out so that folks can have it in their hands and really make functional use of it, not only in their own lives, but in the life of their congregations. I think it's going to be a very useful resource for people who want to be engaging with other Christians in this conversation about how do we, even with whatever secondary or tertiary differences we might have in terms of theology, with those people with whom we share the basic ground, which is Christ in you, Christ in me, right? That notion that the Christian people in whom Christ's Spirit is dwelling, how can we together manifest the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace in the context of our culture in such a way that Jesus through us can reach the people who are currently lost? So I want to thank you for it in advance. We look forward to talking with you about it at length once it's out and people can have it in their hands. Luter, again, thank you for your consistent ministry over the years. But also, I just want to thank you for the genuineness of your spirit and your willingness in every environment that I have ever been in, your willingness to be the person who walks across the room for the conversation with the person who at any given time feels on the outside of the circle. So thank you for the winsomeness of your spirit, and give Mary Lou my deepest affection.
Well, Carmen, thank you. And I could say it's mutual, and really you're helping people reconnect. And I'm glad to be a part of it.
Well, thank you, my friend. We'll talk soon. Okay. That's Luter Whitlock. Thanks for being with us today on The Reconnect. All right, friends, it's high time to go below the fold, the point where we like to lift up stories and make connections designed to help you start or engage with others in conversations that may not initially appear to be about God, but that are going to help you introduce some eternal principles into the conversation that might change not only the course of the conversation, but the way another person is thinking about something. So my friend Jessica likes to call it the surprise factor, right? You could be talking about one thing, and then you as a Christian, you're gonna take hold of a biblical allusion, or you're gonna see in there the reflection of the story of a biblical character or some attribute of God that is just so evident, some biblical principle that you could lift up. And so it's things like when somebody refers to the Good Samaritan, you know, you make sure that they actually know where that story comes from and who that's about and what it's about. So that might be an easy example. Here's one that I grabbed this morning. This is about Johns Hopkins University. Johns Hopkins University, which is certainly a name that you recognize, you may not know that it is just outside of Baltimore, and it's invested millions of dollars to create jobs after the Baltimore riots. And so I want to just lift up a few sentences from this. I picked this up from FaithWire. It says, in the past few years, the city of Baltimore, Maryland has suffered tremendous economic, social, and political instability. Despite this, Johns Hopkins University has remained a thriving Baltimore institution. So as the largest private employer in the state of Maryland, which, by the way, is kind of staggering, Johns Hopkins leadership saw an opportunity to make a positive change in the surrounding community. So in 2015, the university launched a work initiative aimed at providing jobs in struggling neighborhoods. And so from a December 13, 2015 tweet, from the Baltimore Sun, we have this: the Johns Hopkins Hospital to create up to 375 jobs for disadvantaged Baltimore City residents. And then in April of 2016, Johns Hopkins leads $69 million initiative to bring jobs to Baltimore after the riots. And so in addition to pledging the money, I just think that it's really important to hear a few of the testimonies. Here's something from Clayton Smith, a former truck driver. He now works as a supply coordinator at the university. Smith says, having the opportunity to work and having the opportunity to work at a prestigious institution like Johns Hopkins has changed his life. He says, quote, I'm 54 years old and I'm starting a new career and I feel like I have a new lease on life. And then you read down further, and the Taharka brothers, a Baltimore-based ice cream chain, gives this testimony. They sought us out. Hopkins sought us out, the company spokesperson says. I guess they really are trying to use their buying power to buy local products from local businesses. Now, Johns Hopkins is not seeking here a pat on the back. What they're seeking to be is a good steward of the that have been placed within their hands. And that's really one of the points that I want to make out of that. What's the stewardship that you or your company or your church, how are you serving as managers of that which God has placed not only within your hands, but within your reach? Because the $69 million, by the way, didn't all come from Johns Hopkins. They just make the lead gift. And they walked out there and said, look, we're going to do this. Who's with us? Like, what are the other businesses that can come alongside us and we can all collectively really make a significant impact? And so I just encourage you to recognize the dignity of work and to recognize the need for really good jobs to be provided in places that might be difficult for people to find work. One of the things that this article chronicles are the very high percentage of people who are formerly incarcerated who have taken these new positions. And I got to tell you, that's a group of people that has a really hard time finding work. And so if you're in a position to be creating jobs or you're in a position to be expanding what you're doing, let me really encourage you to reach out to maybe some folks who just need a second chance. And be people who demonstrate the redemptive nature of the gospel by doing that. Each one of us has been given the ultimate second chance in Jesus Christ. I mean, there's just no question about that. And those of us who are recipients of grace ought to be people through whom grace then freely flows. The other thing that caught my attention was this. It's called humble bragging, going from people who don't have enough work and don't have enough to do to people who think they have too much work and too much to do. It's called humble bragging, boasting about how a hectic life is the new status symbol. So this particular version of the article is from the Telegraph. Taking the afternoon off for a round of golf or enjoying a beach holiday in a resort, those were once signs of having made it, but today, urbanites are increasingly succumbing to the phenomenon of humble bragging, boasting about their hectic lives as a way to prove that they are in demand. Phrases such as, I have no life, I am desperately in need of a holiday, they are now used to imply social standing. Now, the reality of this is you and I and everyone else, we all have exactly the same amount of time in any given day. Some people accomplish more in those waking hours than other people do. Some people are, you know, what we might describe as real go-getters. And other people, you know, they run, sort of a lower octane pace. And I understand that. But here's the deal. When this article concludes and they talk about, you know, here are four ways that busy people can switch off. And the list includes, finding some space every 6 to 8 weeks or having a download ritual like writing in a journal or taking a break every 90 minutes. Here's what they miss. They miss that in the very beginning, God took a break for a whole day. We call it the Sabbath and we're supposed to honor it. We need rest. We need a break. It's not wrong to take it. So my encouragement to you is take your Sabbath, be still, and know that He is God. Anything you try to do apart from Him is going to be nothing anyway. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect, and I'm Carmen LaBurge. You can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, share today's show with someone new. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.